All right, now we're on Proverbs 25. Now, these are still Proverbs that were written by Solomon, but it tells us in the first verse that they were copied out by the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah. So Solomon originally wrote them, and I guess it was there in the records, but they're the ones that copied them out and included them with the scriptures. So now they go on as part of our Old Testament, the book of Proverbs. So still Solomon, still giving wisdom to his son and further generations. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. Now, you think, well, why would God conceal things? You know, if he wants us to know, why does he conceal them? You know, going through school and when you study science and things, you think, why did God do such a good job of concealing things? Because some of these things are hard to figure out, you know, especially nowadays when you start trying to study quantum mechanics. I'm like, boy, he concealed that one good. I mean, you get weird things, you know. Even Einstein called it weird things at a distance. That's what he called quantum mechanics. He was one of the founders of it. He was pretty smart. But God has, hidden. He's basically built knowledge into the structure of his universe. Okay? And what it is, there's an endless supply that we can study. It's like we never get it down. It'd be kind of sad if we ever knew everything. Because then what would you do? You know? I mean, some of us may think we know everything, but we don't, because there's so much there. It doesn't matter how far you dig. You can take your telescope and search the heavens forever. I mean, I remember I enjoyed going up to the mountains because you get an incredible view of the stars. So one night, I was up at Ruidoso, New Mexico, planning to go up camping, but we didn't get there until after dark, so we didn't go on up to the campsite. So we were in the parking lot. And so I was sleeping on the hood of the car. Okay? So it was August, but it was pretty high and it was cool enough. So I just threw my sleeping bag on the hood of the car. Cars had longer hoods in those days. It was an Oldsmobile Delta 98, so it had a long hood. And so I was just lying there leaning up, you know, had my back up against the windshield and lying there looking up. And there were just so many stars. And because you're up at that higher altitude, the atmosphere obscures them less. No lights around. You weren't in town. And we're about 8,000 feet of altitude. And so you look, and I thought, I'm going to see if I can find a spot with no stars in it. Okay? Just think about it. Think about you're looking at the Big Dipper. Okay? And you see those main stars. You see the Big Dipper. Okay, well, in town, that's about all you see. But out there were all these stars, so I'd keep looking. It's like, okay, there's a patch over here that doesn't seem to have any stars. You'd look at it for a while, and then you'd see all these little stars in it. You couldn't find an empty spot. Everywhere you looked, there were stars in it, okay, just everywhere. So you can look as far as you want. You know, now we've even sent telescopes, you know, into space and got some incredible pictures and seen more. They did the, what was it, deep field survey or something with the Hubble Space Telescope, and they took just one little tiny portion. I forget what it was, it's like 1 degree of the sky or something, you know, and found billions of stars and that, and this and that. And we even have sent, you know, spaceships out to the edge of the solar system and all. And there's just no end to it. We're never going to come to the end of being able to study God's heavens. But you don't have to go out that way. You can take your microscope and go in this way. Just go to the local pond and get you a scoop of pond scum, and you're going to find all kinds of things in there. Living critters going everywhere. Man finally made it in a submarine to the deepest trench in the ocean. Okay? It's deeper than Mount Everest is high. Okay? It's like, I don't know, 33,000 feet deep or something like that. It's incredible, this trench down there. And so they were absolutely certain it would be dead and lifeless like the moon. Okay? Because sunlight doesn't get that far. And sunlight is the basis of our system, right? Sunlight, you know, grows the plankton, which feeds the whales, you know, all that. But they were just sure. So these two men get down there in their little bathysphere. The amazing part is that we've done this thing was a double-hulled ship to stand all that pressure. And on the way down, their windows had two panes of glass, you know, an outer one and an inner one. The outer one cracked on the way down, and they kept going. I'd be like, get me out of here. I've had enough. One didn't make it. Let's go. They said, nah, it'll hold. Just keep going. And they went on down. It didn't crack. They made it fine. But they went on down until they touched the bottom. Then they pop on their lights and look out their little window. And guess what? It was teeming with life everywhere. Even big creatures like squid and things like that. Tons of little creatures. You know, they were just everywhere. Well, what it was is down there, there's basically volcanic vents. They call them black smokers. So basically it's like a volcano going off, and this black smoke comes out, and it produces a lot of heat. And there are plankton-like animals that live off that heat. That's their source of energy. Instead of the sun, they live off that heat. So down there at the bottom, there was life everywhere. It was all over. He made this world for life. Why we spend most of our time looking to Mars for life, I have no idea. Okay, because they're just sure, just like they're sure there was a global flood on Mars, a planet that has no liquid water whatsoever, but they don't believe there was ever a global flood on the Earth, which is over two-thirds liquid water. They don't believe that one. So it doesn't matter which way you look. God's universe, you're not going to come to a limit. You can discover God has hidden great wisdom in his creation, but we have to dig it out. And unfortunately, most of the people who are digging it out put a false interpretation on it. Instead of taking God's word and understanding it, that God created everything, and that explains it, they put an evolutionary idea on it, which says, wasn't God, all this happened by accident, which to me is the ultimate in self-deception. Okay. Then he says, the heavens for height and the earth for depth. That's what we're talking about. There is no end to the height of heaven we could ever see. And the depth of the earth, you've got the depth of the seas, and you've got the depth of the core down in the earth. You know, depths we can never fully explore. And the heart of kings is unsearchable. Okay, rulers, you don't really know exactly why they do what they do. Okay, and I'll say that's true. I don't understand our president and all the things he does. I'm grateful for many of the things he does. But you know, they're a person, a human. No one else ever fully knows another person except God. Take away the dross from the silver, okay? When you refine metal, you heat it up. And what happens when if you take silver and melt it and heat it up enough to the right temperature, then the impurities come out because they have different temperatures, different structures. The impurities will come up and they will heat it up and then skim off the dross, kind of like you skim off the cream with the milk. Okay, it comes to the top. They skim off the dross. So then there shall come forth a vessel for the finer. Okay, finer doesn't mean better; it means refiner, the person craftsman who makes something with it. So if you take just raw silver, it's really not. It's impure. You really can't make much with it. It doesn't work. But if you take away the dross, if you melt it, heat it up and take the dross off, now you've got something they could work with and mold and make a nice vessel with. Take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne shall be established in righteousness. I think that's probably one of the biggest things you can tell about a verse is the company they keep. Okay, especially people in a position of power, people congregate to that. But you've got to be careful because you get the wrong kind of people and the wrong kind of advisors, and you've got problems. So if you take away the wicked, then you can establish a kingdom in righteousness. Put not forth thyself in the presence of the king, and stand not in the place of great men. For it is better that it be said unto thee, come up hither, than thou shalt be put lower in the presence of the prince whom thine eyes have seen. Well, doesn't that sound like Jesus' teaching, who said, you know, don't take the best seats at the banquet, sit down at the lowest, and then he might bring you up. It's better to be brought up from the low room than to be put down from the high one. Well, this was already in Proverbs. It wasn't a new teaching, but it sounds the same because it comes from the same source. The Old Testament is inspired by the Holy Spirit just as much as Jesus' sayings were. So it's the same wisdom. Go not forth hastily to strive, lest thou know not what to do in the end thereof when thy neighbor hath put thee to shame. Have you ever known some people like that, that they just love to fight? Seem like for no good reason, whether it's physical fight or whether it's a verbal fight, whatever. They just like to go up because they're used to winning. But guess what? There's somebody who's bigger and tougher than you are. And that was always my rule. There's always somebody bigger. There's always somebody better. So it's like, don't be in a hurry to get in a fight because you might not win. Then what are you going to do? Debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself and discover not a secret to another. So what do we tend to do? Your neighbor did something to you. It's like, oh, let me tell you what my neighbor did. You know, he did this or he did that. He did this to me. He didn't treat me right. He did this and he did that. Well, what good does it do for me to tell you about it? Is that going to improve the situation? Is that going to make it any better? Go take it up with your neighbor. If you've got a problem with what your neighbor's doing, then go discuss it with him. Don't go just gossiping about it, telling everybody, oh, you wouldn't believe what I saw over at the neighbor's house last night. You know, he came in late and drunk and smacked his car through his garage door and what it will. That doesn't help anything. Lest he that heareth it put thee to shame and thine infamy turn not away. So your neighbor did something shameful. But when you go gossip about it, who does that make look bad? You. Because you're the gossip. And now your dear friend that you just told this story to knows you're a gossip. So they know now that they can't trust you with their matters. So you've made yourself unreliable. So you brought shame upon yourself, really, and not so much upon your neighbor. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. That's kind of hard to picture, but what we've got is apples of gold and pictures of silver. The Jews did not have a lot of artwork. Like we see, we've got artwork, we've got billboards up here. They didn't do that because they were trying to stay away from idolatry, not making images. So a Jew, art to them was like a pot, okay? You made a pot. Think about Solomon in his court. He had all the fanciest whatever. He wouldn't have Michelangelo statues because that's idolatrous. He wouldn't have, it's pornographic too, but he wouldn't have, you know, Rembrandt, Da Vinci pictures and things like that. He would have an ornate column. He would have a drinking vessel that had been formed. And so this kind of pictures, let's say he's got, I think of a cornucopia or something like that. You think of the abundance. So you think of a Thanksgiving cornucopia. So you have this wicker basket shaped like a horn that has all these fruits and things in it. Well, this would be more like a ceramic vessel, but on the outside, it would probably have fruits and, you know, the fruit of the land and fruits and things like that engraved on it to represent the fruitfulness of the land. And so if you had that, and say it was a silver vessel, but then you had this silver vessel, but then maybe you had embossed it in gold to make the apples stand out and look beautiful. It would look beautiful. It would stand out. Those golden apples would stand out on that silver vessel. So it says, a word fitly spoken. So instead of the gossip and this and that, but the right word spoken at the right time is a beautiful decoration like that. When you give someone a compliment, you know, just a little compliment, a sincere one, can go a long way. Or just that somebody noticed and cared enough to say that. You know, we need that kind of encouragement sometimes. As an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. And you don't think of it that way. So you think, okay, get this fancy jewelry, earrings. I mean, that was common in the Middle East, and usually gold, okay, valuable things like that. So it's a decoration. It's something that's beautiful and precious. and we hang it from our ears for some reason. I guess because they're sticking out the side of our head. I guess that's it. I'm just really glad we have ears because it keeps my glasses on. And what would we do if we didn't have ears? Or even worse, if we were apes. Apes don't have enough of a nose. You know, they could never wear glasses because it would fall off. But if you see all these skeletons, I say ape man or something like that, just see if you can put a pair of glasses on it. If there's no place for a bridge, if there's no place to set a pair of glasses, it's an ape. I don't know why they have so much trouble telling the difference. But we don't like to be reproved, okay? We don't like it. It's like, you shouldn't have said that, or you did something wrong. That hurts, right? But it's really like a precious jewel. If you listen, the obedient ear, if you're willing to take that reproof, it does nothing but add to your value. And as the cold of snow in the time of harvest, so is a faithful messenger to them that send him, for he refresheth the soul of his masters. I picture it this way. Harvest is at the end of the summer. Okay, so think of it in September or something like that, a good hot day in September, and you're out working the harvest, and it's hot, and it's dry, and it's hard work, and you don't have a refrigerator or freezer. You can't just go in the house and grab a bucket of ice and make you a nice cold ice water drink like that. But boy, if you're sitting out there working hard like that, don't you long and think about, when the first snows come, because it won't be too long now. It's getting there. The snow, how cool and refreshing. Wouldn't that be nice to have some of that snow right now to quench my thirst and my heat? I know when I played football, we'd come in from practice. And back in those days, they were so smart, they decided it was bad for you to drink water. Okay, so you're out there in the heat and you're sweating and this and that. And they thought if you drank water, you'd get waterlogged. So they wouldn't let us have any water. So you've been out there sweating for a couple of hours. And so then you come into the locker room, which has one water fountain. Okay, the line at the water fountain was incredible. Okay, and people didn't just take a drink and walk off. I mean, they turned it on and they sat there because everybody's dehydrated. We're very thirsty and this and that. And you'd have to wait for, 30 minutes or so to get to the water fountain. So what I got in the habit of doing when I'd come in from practice is I'd go to the trainer's room. And in the trainer's room, he was a real nice Christian man. He had a big ice maker because he used it for, sprained ankles and all that kind of stuff. And I would go in there, and he'd let me get in, and I would make this ball of ice. You just pack it in and just make you this big old ball of ice about this big. Then I'd go outside and walk around the track to cool down, and I would eat this ball of ice. Because, that was just the best thing because there was a lot of water in that. You could just sit there and eat that. It was crushed ice, and you could eat it, and it would melt, and it would satisfy your thirst. Not as fast as you wanted. You really wanted to glug down a big jug of water. But that ball of ice would satisfy that. Now, my tongue would go numb, and I couldn't talk. But, but I didn't care because that ice was so good it quenched your thirst. Well, that's kind of it. You're out working in the harvest and the heat, but you think about that snow of winter. That would be very refreshing. It says, that's the way a faithful messenger is to them that send him. Okay? In these days, you didn't have text. You didn't have email. You didn't even have telephone. If you had a message to get to somewhere, you had to send it with a messenger, a runner. That's all you had, is you had to say, here, go take this message to wherever. Okay, that's how the marathon started, when the guy in Marathon, Greece had to run 26 miles, who ran to give him the message and then died. Okay, that's a great thing to celebrate. But if that messenger wasn't faithful, he didn't give your message. How would you like it if you send this messenger and he goes, you've got an important message for the king. And so you send this messenger and the messenger gets there and says, yeah, he told me something about, let's see, what did he say? That doesn't help. Or if he doesn't tell him what you intended, if he changes it for his own purposes, that's not good either. So what you want is someone who will convey the message faithfully. Okay. Well, that's what we are as the church. We're meant to convey God's message faithfully. Now, fortunately, unlike what they like to say a lot of times, they say, the Bible was passed down by oral tradition and it changed over the years. And I said, no, it didn't. It was written down. And it was written down. I believe it was written down from the start. I think Adam started writing it down. Okay. There's no reason Adam couldn't write. Okay. God made him fully grown. He could make him fully educated too. And so he wrote it down and he passed it on to Seth, and Seth passed it on, you know, and it gets down to Lamech and Methuselah and to Noah, and Noah passes it down, and it finally winds up in Moses' hands. And Moses compiled it all together and got it down to us eventually. So the thing that we have is we don't have to depend on just what we hear. You don't have to depend on just what the preacher says. You got the word itself to go check it against. You can be a Berean and search the scriptures daily to see if what he said was true. So if you know, if you really like Joel Osteen and think he's wonderful, and I say something bad about him and you disagree with him, that's fine. Just go to the scriptures and see if what he has to say agrees with the scriptures. And if it agrees with the scriptures, I'm fine with it. For they send him, for it refreshes the soul of his masters. He does his job faithfully. That's what God depends on us to do, is to faithfully represent him. And that's with our life, too. We need to represent. We call ourselves Christians, so we need to act like it. Whoso boasteth himself of a false gift is like clouds and wind without rain. Okay, well, everybody likes to say how wonderful they are at this or how wonderful they are at that. But if you're really not, if you're not doing it, then you're like clouds and wind without rain. Think about a dry country, a country that doesn't get much rain. And the clouds blow up, and you think, oh, good, we sure need a good rain today. And these big old clouds up there with all these tons of water in them, they blow up and come, and then they just blow right over. Doesn't drop any rain. We don't get anything out of it. They did us no good, right? They got our hopes up and then disappointed because they didn't deliver anything. Well, that's what we can be like if we say, oh, yes, you know, I'm great and wonderful. I really care about you, but then I let you starve. You know, that doesn't do any good. By long forbearing is a prince persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bone. So it's not to be overpowering and intimidating, but it's persistence to keep up the same message. Hast thou found honey? Okay, the Bible always talks positively about honey. Eat so much as is sufficient for thee. So it didn't say don't eat it, but it said don't eat more than you need. Eat as much as you need, lest thou be filled therewith and vomited. What good does it do if you eat so much it makes you sick and you lose it? You didn't get any good out of it. It's good, but like Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, there's a time for everything. There's a right time and there's a right amount. And at the right time, it's great. It's kind of like they say, hunger is the best seasoning. Okay, have you ever had when you're not really hungry but you want something and nothing tastes good? It's because you're not hungry. You really don't need anything. But if you ever been really hungry, it really didn't matter much. I forget where was it. We heard a story recently about a little girl that just wouldn't eat anything. She was just spoiled and thought everything was terrible, and she never would eat anything. And then so. The dad let her get good and hungry, and then he took her to some place to eat. It wasn't the best food in the world. It wasn't really that, but she ate that, and she was hungry, and she's like, okay, I'll only eat there. Their food is good. You know, the rest of the food is bad, but their food is good. It's because she was finally hungry. That's why she thought their food was good. Now, I love this one. Withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he be weary of thee and so hate thee. Okay, it's pretty sure. We think Benjamin Franklin was so smart with all his sayings. Well, Benjamin, one of his sayings was, visitors, house guests, and our fish are much alike. After 3 days, they start to smell. Okay, well, Solomon said it a long time before Benjamin Franklin. And he said it more straightforward. He just said, you know, it's nice to go and visit, but know when it's time to leave. Don't wear out your welcome. Leave when they still want you to come back, you know. A man that beareth false witness against his neighbor is a maul and a sword and a sharp arrow. Those are all dangerous weapons. You know, a maul you beat somebody with, a sword and a sharp arrow, but that's what you're doing if you're bearing false witness against somebody, because you're getting them in trouble through your witness. So you said, well, it's just words. I didn't hurt him. No, you used your words to bring harm to someone else, like giving false testimony under oath, something like that. You can falsely get someone convicted of a crime because of what you said. Well, that's just as much as if you go went out there and beat them with a stick. Confidence in an unfaithful man in a time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint. Now, that's a very picturesque saying, okay? You got to be careful who you put your trust in. And they may seem fine as long as things are good, but when things get tough, are they really faithful? Can you really trust them? Or are they like a broken tooth? It may not hurt just normally, but try to bite down on something hard and it gives on you and it really hurts. Or your ankle is out of joint. It's fine until you step on it, you know. Angela's fine with her foot sitting there up on the bench, feels just fine. But if she had to jump up and run, it would hurt. It's unreliable. And what happens? You just collapse. It doesn't support you. So that's a very vivid picture there. As he that taketh away a garment in cold weather, and is vinegar upon nitre, so is he that singeth songs to a heavy heart. Okay, well, first, the illustration. I mean, take away a garment in cold weather, that wouldn't be appreciated. But vinegar upon nitre. Okay, if you don't believe that, nitre is just baking soda. Okay, and if you want to get a vivid illustration, now I suggest you do it in the sink or someplace, you have to clean it up, but just take you some baking soda and mix it up in water. And then just take some vinegar and pour it in. And you probably know exactly what's going to happen, didn't it? It's going to bubble and boil, and if it has a lid on it, it's going to blow it right off. I mean, you're going to cause quite a reaction. We used to love it back when we were in science classes, and you'd have a lab, and sometimes you get to have a little chunk of sodium. Potassium and stuff was worse, but a little chunk of sodium, and that stuff reacts with water. And it was really fun to go out to a pond and take a block about this big and chunk it out there, and it would start like a firecracker, whizzing and popping and shooting around because it would be going off, and that water would run all over the lake. It was really funny. But it was when we were doing potassium, that we would do some in chemistry lab, and you were supposed to put just a little bitty bit. We had just a little bit you'd get me put in this test tube, and then we were going to react it with some things. But the teacher made very clear that test tube needs to be dry. Because if there's water in that test tube, it's going to blow up as soon as you drop that potassium in there. And so I remember in my chemistry class, I had fifth period right before athletics. I had fifth period. And so I came in just a little bit early, and the fourth period class was just getting out. And there was smoke everywhere. There was just smoke. And I was like, oh, what is it? Why were they still there? They were late. They were cleaning up all the glass from somebody dropping it in because they washed out their beaker. You're supposed to wash it because you want it clean, nothing else in it. But they didn't get it dried out, dropped the potassium, and it blew. I mean, smoke filled that whole room and lab and everything else. And I asked the teacher what happened. She said, well, that's what happens. Like, oh, okay. So then when we get to our lab, we do our little lecture, and then we get to our lab. I'm over there, and I was going over to get something. I was walking right by somebody, and they were about to drop their potassium in, and I could see the water drops in the test tube that they were just about to drop it in. I was like, no, stop, wait, don't do that. They just did that last period. We don't want to do that again. So it does. So now he's saying that kind of a reaction is the same way you feel when you sing songs to a heavy heart. Okay, that may not be what they need all the time. Sometimes it really can. You know, songs can lift our spirits. It can really help. But there's also times not to. It just depends on the situation. You have to use it. Realize, especially if you're doing it obliviously, you know, I'm happy, whatever, so I'm just saying, here, aren't you happy too? And then you're not. I'm not identifying with you very well or being considerate of your feelings. I'm just doing mine. So it can, being cheerful is a wonderful thing, but sometimes it's not always appropriate. If thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. For thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Lord shall reward thee. Okay. So I've heard this mostly one way, but I've heard it two different ways. And I tend to side, I think, with the road less traveled. But mostly what you hear is, if you will be kind to your enemy, take care of them, you know, feed them, give them water, whatever, then you will heap coals of shame on their head, and that will help them to repent. But I don't think that really makes sense. Because you're really being mean to them, right? You're doing it to be mean to them. That's your purpose here, right? God said that if you will be kind to them, that will heap coals on their head. So good, I'm putting some burning coals on your head. You deserve it. But I don't think in their culture that was the way it was. Because heap coals of fire. Coals of fire, the expression there is the warm embers that you keep from a fire, okay? Fires are hard to start. Without matches, we're spoiled because we've got matches. But I've been camping, and I've not had matches sometimes. And you're in trouble. If your matches get wet, oh, boys, you take all of this care. You buy special waterproof matches. You get your matches, and you put them in a little waterproof bottle, and you wrap them in foil. You do everything you can to keep your matches dry. Because if your matches aren't dry, you're going to have a cold night and you're going to eat cold food. Because unless you're pretty good, starting a fire with rubbing two sticks together is going to take all night long. That is not something you do quickly and easily. It's hard to start a fire. Okay? So what did God do with the fire on the altar at the tabernacle? Well, God started it to begin with. He started it with fire from heaven. And then they never put it out. What they did when it was time to finish for the day, you heap up your ashes and pack those coals, and you pack them, and then the next day when you start the fire again, there's enough heat still in that. You open it up, put a little kindling on it, and start it back up. It's much, much easier. Okay, the fire they used in the temple always came from that same fire. Because remember what happened when they brought strange fire before the Lord? Aaron, two of his sons did that, and it didn't go over too well. God didn't like that. Well, when you give someone the gift of fire, you've not only fed him when he was hungry and given him drink when he was thirsty, you've also given him a fire that he can take home. And he can use that to start a fire in his house and cook his supper and warm his hut. And whatever, you've rewarded him with that. You've given him that fire that he can carry it home. And then God will reward you. You've been kind, not that anything good for you. You didn't take revenge. You showed kindness. How God uses that in his life is up to God. He may use that to reach him and get him to repent. And he may not. The guy may be just as much an enemy as he ever was. But God is going to reward you because you showed kindness to your enemy. Isn't that the way God has done us? While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, okay? That's the way God acts. That's a Christian way to act. The north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry countenance a backbiting tongue. Have you ever noticed when people are really just getting nasty and gossiping? I know people talk about a lot of things, and we probably are indiscreet and say more things than we should, but I'm talking about when somebody is being nasty about somebody else. They're just being downright nasty about them, and you know it. If you don't participate and you just give them one of these looks, doesn't it usually shut it up pretty quick? Instead of joining and saying, oh, yeah, I know, she's always like that, or whatever, somebody's just having at somebody, and you're just kind of like, really? Is that what you're going to talk about? Or if you just turn away, it's like you can put an end to that pretty quickly. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. I think that's the third time we've hit that. But, you know, Solomon had 1,000 wives, you know. He knew all about dwelling with brawling women. I'm sure he did. Because I could just about guarantee you if you've got more than one wife, you've got brawling women. I mean, you just do. Either they fight with each other or they fight with you. You know, I mean, I've heard enough stories about like the truck driver who had 3 different wives in 3 different towns. You know, he drove around the country and he had 3 different towns. They finally figured it out. And so they worked it out. One of the wives got him to come to a motel in Vegas or something like that. And they killed him. You know, they got together and killed him. It's like, well, you know. So Solomon must have known a lot about a brawling woman. He said, he had big houses, but it probably wasn't big enough for all of them. That's why I think he had separate houses. Most of his wives, you notice, he had his house. It took him 7 years or whatever to build his house, and then he built a separate house for his wives. I think he had a reason for that, you know, put them in a different house, so at least he had some place to go. That was, you know, now I think we have man caves now. The guy goes out in the garage and this and that. Or I know a lot of guys I used to work with, it's different because they work compressed shifts. Like 10, for efficiency work, which means you work 12-hour days, 3 or 4 days a week, and then you're off for 3 or 4 days. And almost all of them, I mean, they were the hands-on kind of guys, mechanics and this and that. Almost all of them had some kind of a hobby. You know, a lot of them worked on old cars. One guy built stagecoaches. He built beautiful, you know, stagecoaches, all leather and, you know, just unbelievable. I can't believe they had time to do all this kind of stuff. Well, with their days off, that's what they did. But mostly they did it to stay out of the house. Because usually they were on their third or fourth wife. And so they had discovered that they got along better and stayed married longer when they stayed out in the garage. That's what he got. It just really shocked me. I was right out of school. I didn't really know anything in these guys, but I get like, yeah, that's what you do with your time off. You spend your time there. But I found that they were usually on their third or fourth wife. As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. Cold waters is just something. I know I spent just a week on a mission trip in Central America, and we had no refrigeration, so you didn't get anything cold to drink. And the water, us Americans couldn't take the native water. It wasn't purified and everything like around here. And so you had to put iodine in it. So I drank warm yellow water, brown water maybe, all week. When I came back, probably for 3 months at least, I drank nothing but ice water. That's all I wanted, you know, no Cokes, no coffee, no juice, no anything. I wanted ice, and not just water, ice water. It had to be ice water. I really missed it. It was really refreshing more than anything else. And that's the way good news can be. It can be really refreshing to your soul. A righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain in a corrupt spring. You know, shouldn't be that way. The righteous should not be worshiping the wicked. This one makes me think of when Satan came to the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. And what was Satan's last temptation? Well, sorry. Was all this I will give to you if you will just fall down and worship me. He could have saved the cross. He could have saved all the misery of that and all that. But Jesus Christ bowing down to Satan would be the greatest abomination in history. And so he says, you know, a righteous falling down before the wicked is like a spring. You know, a spring can be a great refreshing thing, but if it's poison, then it's not. It is not good to eat much honey. Okay, he's got that one twice in this same psalm. So for men to search their own glory is not glory. So for us to pat ourselves on the back and to brag and this and that isn't really glory. I think I told you before, when I was in high school, we had a young man who I think had some self-esteem problems in the sense that he didn't feel like he was appreciated or valuable or this and that, because his dad was a top NFL lineman. Okay, he'd been very successful, very athletic. And this kid was this tall, gangly kid. In junior high, the coaches had to order special football cleats for him because you couldn't buy any in the store in his size. You know, they were like 15s or 16s or something like that. And they had to special order them, and they came in, and it looked like something Vince Lombardi probably would have been comfortable with. I mean, they were high top leather. They were just so old fashioned. It was amazing. They must have been stuck back in a warehouse somewhere, and they finally found somebody big enough to wear them. You know, and he had these big old feet and this and that. But he was always a bragger, drove everybody crazy, because he was always bragging about how great he was and this and that. We were just like, man, leave us alone. You know, we're tired of hearing it. And very irritating. But then his junior year in high school, he went to state and track in the high jump. And he won. He won the high jump statewide his junior year and this and that. And so we were I remember standing in line at the cafeteria waiting to get our food, and several of us were talking. It's like, oh, he's going to be insufferable. You know, he's won this now. We're never going to hear the end of it. But one of my friends said, no. He said, let me talk to him. And so when he walked in, he walked right up to him before he had a chance to say anything. And he said, you know, what you did, that was an amazing accomplishment. You won state. And I think you should get to brag all you want the whole month. He never said a word. Not one word about it. He didn't tell us about it. Nothing. That satisfied him right there, because somebody acknowledged that he had accomplished something and gave him some affirmation. And he was happy. He didn't brag at all. That was it. So glorifying yourself is not glory. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. We've got so much of that now. People don't have self-discipline anymore. We were talking about the other day, kind of the way the kids have been raised, you know, the disciplining your kids fell out of fashion. It started back when I was a kid with Dr. Spock and that sort of thing. You weren't supposed to discipline your kids and this and that. You know, you weren't doing any corporal punishment. Then it got to where in school you couldn't give them licks for anything anymore. And then on and on and on. It got to where now, not the kids that are in school now, the parents of the kids that are in school now don't have any discipline. They're rebellious and never got disciplined, and so they sure aren't going to allow you to discipline their kid, and you know they have no discipline at all. They have no self-control. That's a miserable life to live when you don't even have control over your own self. That's just a miserable thing. Well, here he describes it as like a city with broken down walls. Okay, this was in a country that your safety was those walls around the city. That's what kept you safe from marauders and robbers and everything. You could lock the gates at night and be safe in your home. But if you don't have any self-control, you're like a city just totally exposed. You're vulnerable. You can't even control yourself. You're not safe from yourself, much less anybody else.